In 2018, the body of 24-year-old Toya Cordingley was found on a secluded beach in Australia's far north. Now, the man accused of her murder is facing trial. Rajwinder Singh has pleaded not guilty, and in the case of Toya's murder, we'll bring you all the details from the courtroom as he fights the charges in this highly anticipated trial. Search for the Case Of podcast in the ABC Listener or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, will the federal government launch an independent review of childcare standards? It was recommended by the Productivity Commission last September, and you've probably heard about the Four Corners investigation revealing how pedophiles had infiltrated the system. So how will the government respond? You'll hear from the Minister for Early Childhood Education. Then, how do you know if video content online is real, or if it's made by artificial intelligence? We'll hear about one solution being proposed to watermark content from AI generators. Then, overseas, a colonial threat. That's what Venezuela has labelled Donald Trump's latest warning about the South American country. We'll turn there and we'll cross to Asia to hear about an intervention that he may have made in Asian politics between China and Japan over Taiwan. There's a lot to it. We'll make sure you get right across the detail. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thanks for joining us for another week of The Breakfast Wrap. We've got a lot of stories to cover, including a couple overseas and a few featuring discussions in Canberra. We're going to start with this one, looking back at last year's Four Corners program on ABC TV. The revelations from this episode were harrowing. It exposed cases of child abuse and alleged child abuse, neglect, and injury within the childcare sector. It highlighted real critical gaps in safety and accountability. The Productivity Commission recommended an independent review of national childcare standards, but the federal government is yet to commit to such a review. Meanwhile, early childhood educators, who are some of the lowest paid workers in the country, will get a pay rise from today. With so much to cover, we invited on the Minister for Early Childhood Education, Jess Walsh, and Sally Sara got straight to the point.
Will there be an independent review as recommended by the Productivity Commission?
The Productivity Commission recommended the pay rise that we're celebrating today, and it made a number of other recommendations as well. In terms of reviewing the National Quality Framework, the National Quality Framework was legislated back in 2010. It was reviewed in 2019. We're focused today on the urgent actions that are required to strengthen the sector, including with this pay rise, an $11,000 a year pay bump for our nation's early educators, and a really important measure to keep them in the sector and to build a strong and stable workforce.
So to come back to the question about an independent review, the one recommended by the Productivity Commission, is that a no?
It's not a no. A review of the National Quality Framework is something that could happen in the future. It was one of many recommendations of the Productivity Commission in their review into a pathway to universal early education in this country. Another one of the big recommendations was the pay rise. This is a workforce that has been underpaid and undervalued for too long. When we took office, that meant that early educators were leaving the sector in droves. We wanted to see a strong, stable workforce to deliver quality early education, and that's why we've committed to this pay rise, and it is paying dividends. It's reducing turnover in the sector. It's allowing educators to stay in jobs that they love. That's good for them, but it's also good for the children in their care, because a strong, stable workforce is the foundation for quality early education.
So can you tell me the government's thinking here? Because one recommendation by the Productivity Commission for this wage increase, you've grabbed onto that and implemented it, but the independent review, you're saying something that could happen, but there's nothing definite there. What's the government's thinking? Why the different approaches there?
So we're implementing the Productivity Commission's findings. The pay rise was a big one. Another one you'll remember, Sally, was to replace the activity test with guaranteed 3-day subsidy for every child, no matter what their parents do, and that will roll out from January 5. Another recommendation was that we deal with childcare deserts where children don't have access to early learning in our outer suburbs and regions as much as they should, and that's why we're delivering $1 billion Building Early Education Fund.
There's urgency with those other issues. Why not on the independent review?
So we are certainly acting with urgency, Sally, when it comes to the matters that you spoke about earlier. We are strengthening the sector, not just with this pay rise, but with a whole lot of measures that were announced back in August, the biggest changes to the National Quality Framework, actually, in the 15 years of operation of that system. We're investing in mandatory child safe training for our educators. We're developing the first ever register of early childhood educators. We are providing more information to parents. We're strengthening the penalties. We're improving the regulation of the sector. So we're focused on the urgent actions to keep children safe. And we're focused on building a strong and stable sector. And this pay rise is a big part of that.
Minister, what update can you provide on efforts to standardise working with children checks across states and territories? Is that completed?
That's work that's being undertaken by the Attorneys General. So both the Attorneys General group around the country and the Education Ministers are very focused on all the measures that are needed to keep children safe. What the Attorneys General have announced is a national system where if you're banned in one state, you'll be banned in every state.
When does that come into effect? Just the dates of that?
The dates would be with the Attorneys General because it's in their portfolio. But what they've said is if you're banned in one state, you'll be banned in every state. And they're also moving to a real time checking of working with children's check approach. From the early childhood perspective, I just want to be clear that if you don't have a valid working with children check in early childhood education, you can't work in the sector, and that real-time reporting will be really helpful.
And that is the Minister for Early Childhood Education, Jess Walsh, speaking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. Have you fallen for fake AI content online? Footage generated by artificial intelligence seems to be everywhere right now, from fake home movies of pets doing funny things to the recent trend of Hollywood behind-the-scenes footage dreamt up by artificial intelligence. Then there's the more, perhaps, sinister uses portraying false or misleading footage from war zones all around the world. Different videos have varying levels of believability and detectability, so the federal government is hoping to make it easier for Australians to work it all out. It's asking AI developers to label their content. Our political correspondent, Melissa Clark, came on to explain.
What the federal government is now asking AI developers to do, or anyone using AI programs, is to label their content as AI generated and embed a watermark and in metadata that this is an AI generated image or text or document. Now, this is something that they're encouraged to adopt. It is not a mandatory provision. It's part of guidelines aimed at building trust and increasing transparency when it comes to AI. I think it's interesting we're hearing about this detail today because you might have noticed there's been a few AI announcements lately, Sally. We had last week the AI Safety Institute as a new body being set up to monitor and respond to AI risks. Today we have this guidance around identifying AI-generated content. Effectively, what we're getting is a few of the details that'll be part of a broader national AI plan.
And when are we expecting this national AI plan to be released? There's not many days left on the calendar.
Any moment now, absolutely any moment now. This is an issue and a process the government has been going through that extended right into the last term of government, has come into this term of government. We have had a lot of input to this, including the fairly important Productivity Commission report, which had really encouraged the government to take a light touch approach to managing or regulating AI, not proceed down the line of a broader AI act, an all-encompassing act that would look to regulate AI. And it seems ultimately the government has generally adopted this approach, although some of the details recommended by the Productivity Commission haven't been or, and won't be followed through with, things like exempting text and data mining from copyright laws. That's been rejected. But I think when we get this national AI plan from the government very soon, we can expect to see the kind of light touch approach that the Productivity Commission was recommending. It really has taken a while to get to this point. There's a couple of things we might be able to look to for that. Obviously, the evolution of AI, even just in the last 12 to 18 months, when you think of how far we've progressed from the earliest days of ChatGPT to where we are now with so many different language models and providers, how quickly it's being integrated into all parts of the economy, means it's very hard to keep pace with this kind of development. There's been big internal disagreement within the government about the way to proceed forward, in particular whether to have that overarching AI Act or whether to look at individual areas where AI is influencing. And just the breadth of issues, everything from developing data centres to how AI interacts with the workplace, copyright laws that we've talked about. This is a really big issue for the government to tackle, and it seems it's nearly ready to give us the full plan.
Mel, we were hearing from Jess Walsh, the Minister for Early Childhood Education, on reforms in that sector and the speed and milestones of those reforms.
Yeah, not a lot of confirmation of some of the dates around that. Look, I think it's worth just picking up on a couple of details here. The issue around the Productivity Commission's recommendation for an independent review of national childcare standards. Now, that, as proposed, would cover things like child safety, but also governance and rules around quality assessments, those sorts of issues. Now, what we heard from Jess Walsh in that interview was, well, it's not a no, a review could happen in the future. It was certainly anything but a yes, I think is how you would perhaps best describe it. And we also got no clear answer as to, well, why not? Or why not now? Now, there might be good reasons for that. We have seen the minister in the past point to the fact that, you know, there is a desire from the federal government to move towards a more universal system and perhaps a review that is broader. There would be a more appropriate time for that in the future. But that wasn't very clearly articulated by Jess Walsh in that interview. And I think that makes it harder for people to understand why the government is taking the approach that it has.
Mel Clark there, political correspondent for Radio National Breakfast.
Earlier, Mr. Trump posted on social media to all airlines, pilots, drug dealers and human traffickers, please consider the airspace above and surrounding Venezuela to be closed in its entirety.
Well, let's just show you some light. Well, those comments haven't been taken lightly in Caracas, Venezuela, condemning US President Donald Trump's latest warning about its airspace, calling it a colonial threat. Tensions between the US and Venezuela have been escalating. The US is stepping up its military presence in the region. It's also carried out repeated strikes on boats that it claims are tied to the drug trade, killing those on board on the high seas. The death toll from those strikes now stands at more than 80 people. Donald Trump's comments have also angered members of Congress in the US. They say he's edging towards military action without their approval. Meanwhile, Venezuela accuses Washington of using drug allegations as a cover to try and force the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, from power. Latin America correspondent for The Times, John Bonfilio, joined Sally for his analysis.
John, how should we interpret these comments from Donald Trump suggesting the airspace around Venezuela should be regarded as closed?
I mean, it's interesting because he has no authority to be able to declare that airspace closed. But I think the best way to interpret it is as a continuation of his attempt, his administration's attempt to choke the Venezuelan administration and specifically Nicolas Maduro from power. I think that there's two ways of looking at what's been taking place in the last couple of months. On the one hand, every day brings a new threat or escalation of what is about to happen. But on the other hand, if you step back from the noise, very little has actually taken place. I think the truth is that however much Trump threatens military action, external regime change and installing an administration favorable to the US would require boots on the ground. And Trump's MAGA base is virulently opposed to forever wars. Now, drones and missiles in Venezuela is something else altogether. But the fact is, he's painted himself into a corner. It's naked gunboat diplomacy that we're seeing off the coast of Venezuela, the use of military threats to achieve a desired political and economic outcome. But the big question is, if your opponent, Maduro in this case, doesn't heed the threat, what then?
John, is it a sign that the US is preparing to take military action, or is it empty talk in your view?
I think it's been empty talk. I mean, if you look at the scale of what's built up off the coast of Venezuela in the Southern Caribbean, it so far exceeds what, not in terms of troop numbers, but so far exceeds what you would need in terms of actually undertaking sort of key strikes into the country. The problem is that by this stage, Trump would have hoped that Maduro would have stepped to one side and have opened up Venezuela, the Venezuelan markets to the US economy. But that hasn't happened. So the fact is that we now have a situation in which something has to give. And given the fact that Donald Trump doesn't normally take a backward step, it is likely to involve some kind of military action somewhere down the line.
Latin America correspondent for The Times, John Bonfilio there, speaking about this tension between Caracas and Washington as the US ramps up its threats against Venezuela. Is Japan going through its worst diplomatic crisis in years? Or does the new prime minister have everything under control? According to several media reports, the US President Donald Trump has asked Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takai has asked Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi not to further escalate a diplomatic dispute with China as he tries to preserve a fragile trade war truce with Beijing. But the Japanese PM's office has disputed that account. Beijing-Tokyo relations have soured in recent weeks following remarks by Ms. Takaichi suggesting Tokyo could intervene militarily in the case of an attack on Taiwan. Sally asked Tokyo-based political science professor Koichi Nakano if, in his view, this was a serious diplomatic deterioration.
Yes, indeed. I'm afraid so. Prime Minister Takaichi already sort of, discussed the possibility in parliament without really being prompted to do so, in fact, that Japan can intervene militarily in case of a Taiwan contingency. But of course, for Japan to intervene in other countries' dispute militarily is considered to be unconstitutional traditionally. And so there is that. And then, of course, on top of that, there is the fact that Taiwan was a Japanese colony up until the end of the Second World War. So for Japan to suggest that is going to rub China in our own way for sure.
So was this a genuine mistake, or is the Japanese Prime Minister actually breaking from the strategic ambiguity policy of her predecessors?
Well, the general understanding is that it was more of a slip of a tongue than something that was pre-planned. It seems that the government officials were seriously panicking after the Prime Minister said that because she went off the script. So a lot of people blame Prime Minister Takaichi, or actually praise, in some cases, Prime Minister Takaichi for having said that rather, by her own initiative. At the same time, of course, Prime Minister Takaichi has been known to have a very strongly pro-Taiwan, anti-Chinese view before she became Prime Minister. So even though, it was a slip of a tongue, it was not out of her character at the same time.
Japan has so far resisted China's demands for Ms. Takaichi to retract the comment. Do you think she could back down?
At this point, I think a lot of people in the government think that it's too late, that she has already, dug her heel, as it were, and therefore for her to retract would be basically for her to have to resign.
Just briefly, do you think that Donald Trump may be prepared to soften support for Taiwan in pursuit of a trade deal with China?
I think that's absolutely possible. I think you'd be naive not to think that that's a possibility.
From Tokyo, that was political science professor Koichi Nakano talking about that tension between China and Japan. Well, we're going to finish with federal politics because the opposition is gearing up for a new political fight on immigration. Shadow Home Affairs Minister John O'Dunham yesterday floated the idea of a citizenship-style test for Australian values for aspiring migrants. He told the Sunday Telegraph that the current test standards need to be improved. Amanda Vanstone is the former Immigration and Multicultural Affairs Minister in the coalition government of John Howard. She told Sally that before we have this debate, we need to understand a common set of principles on immigration.
So the first principle is, I think, non-discriminatory on the basis of where you come. Now, we've always had a lot of people from the UK, but that's an historical link. We've had a lot of people from China and India. Well, we're in the Indo-Pacific, what do you expect? But after those three, the spread is quite phenomenal over some 20 or more countries. And that's a good thing, I think. So that would be my first principle. Let's keep a really good mix of people coming. There's a bit of debate over skilled versus semi-skilled, unskilled. We've liked to have skilled immigration and you come young enough that we can use your skills, you know, not come at 60 and you retire at 65. We want you here, I think, by 43 or something. But, of course, every skilled migrant brings some people with them, some of whom are unskilled. So we need to bring in the people we need.
The Howard government introduced a multiple-choice citizenship in late 2007. In reality, how effective was it?
What do you mean multiple-choice citizenship?
There was no citizenship test at that stage?
2007, I was in Italy then, Sally.
Right, okay.
But look, I'm not sure about tests. It depends who devises them. I mean, we have great bureaucrats, I think. The Australian Public Service does a fabulous job. But, you know, do I need to be interested in cricket to come here? Well, I'm not, so I wouldn't get here. I've got some anxiety about those tests, but that's not to say you couldn't devise one that was effective.
What have you made of the initial statements from some in the coalition, including those not in leadership roles in the coalition, about the issue of immigration, the way that they are framing that debate?
Well, not just people in the coalition. Everybody, I think, is jumping on a bandwagon to have a quick and easy discussion. You know, have we got too many people? They haven't looked at how many are coming. They haven't looked at the makeup of those that are coming. It's just one of those yelling across the town square debates. So I hope we can have a much more informed debate. I don't mean people knowing a lot of detail because, you know, we can't know, we don't want to know a lot of detail about a whole range of policies, but at least understand the basics of, you know, do you want parent reunion, for example? Can the last surviving parent come? What if they're old and require a lot of medical care? I mean, there are a lot of very difficult questions in immigration, and I don't think we should treat it as a simple more or less, you know, how many can we have? It's the makeup that's important, not just the countries you come from, but what skills you've got.
Is immigration fertile ground as the coalition faces historically low result in the election and also renewed popularity from One Nation?
I don't know. I mean, One Nation is a bit of a headline seeker without necessarily coming up with detailed policies. And I think you can understand why people in the major parties aren't very sympathetic to that, because government is about a lot more than just yelling out a slogan or saying something that people generally agree with. You've then got to go and do the detail and implement the policy. So while I agree with some of the things One Nation says, not all, obviously, I'm not really sympathetic to them because they don't have the minds of people that are going to have to govern one day. And that's a lot harder than just chanting slogans.
And you were just listening to Amanda Vanstone, the former Immigration and Multicultural Affairs Minister in the Howard government. She was speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. That is The Breakfast Wrap for today. Monday, the first day of the week. You'll be able to listen to each episode of The Breakfast Wrap live at 11:30 on Radio National, or slightly earlier on the ABC Listen app. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Josie Sargent. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. See you tomorrow.